Today's episode is brought to you by Oak Tree Products, the ultimate one-stop shop for audiologists, hearing professionals, and sound professionals. If you're looking for diagnostic or screening equipment, this is the place for you. From the essentials to the hard-to-find tools, Oak Tree has you covered. We've personally been ordering from them for years, and they've always come through. We recently just ordered new diagnostic equipment for four offices through Oak Tree.
During the pandemic, when supplies were hard to come by and everything was up in the air, Oak Tree kept things in stock and moving. They've handled supply chain disruptions, tariff uncertainty, all of it without missing a beat. Whether you're outfitting a new practice or just need to stock up, check them out at oaktreeproducts.com. Again, that's oaktreeproducts.com. We will link to them in the episode description and tell them we sent you when you visit oaktreeproducts.com.
Oh my God, hey, feels like the perfect way to welcome today's guest. This is genuinely one of the most excited I've ever been for an interview. Mickey Joe Boucher, better known as Mickey Joe Theater, is one of the world's leading theater critics and the creator of one of the largest YouTube channels dedicated to theater criticism. Over the years, he's built a reputation for insightful, passionate, and refreshingly honest takes on all things theater, exploring and analyzing the magic of the stage. Whether you're a seasoned theatergoer or curious about what makes a great performance, you're in for a conversation that's as thoughtful as it is entertaining. Mickey Joe, welcome to Hear Us Out. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. That was a lovely introduction.
Thank you. So why don't we start by telling our audience how you actually became a theater critic in the first place?
Great. So wildly accidentally is the short answer, because when I first started doing things on social media, making videos on YouTube, it was never to be about theater criticism. I had, for years before that, had secret theater blogs where I would write about the shows I would go and see as a teenager, and that I would never share it anywhere and nobody would see any of these reviews. And then when I started making YouTube videos, I was emulating what I saw other people doing, which wasn't particularly theater criticism. And I had a thing at the time, I was convinced a video couldn't be more than 10 minutes long, because nobody would want to watch a video that was that long, because it wasn't what I was watching. And then I sort of accidentally slipped into doing more and more criticism and reviewing, and then the videos got longer and longer. And now I speak for like an hour at a time about some productions and share multiple reviews a week. But it's truly something that just sort of came along accidentally as theaters were reopening after the shutdown.
You know, I think the term criticism gets a bad name, that we think of criticism in a negative light. Can you talk about how criticism can be informed, how it can lead to improvement, better understanding, kind of your goal behind being a critic?
Yeah. And I agree. I think when you hear criticism, when you hear critique, it sounds inherently very negative, because that's the connotation, that's the way that we use it in everyday. I was paid an extraordinary compliment once. Somebody passed something along and said that someone had referred to me as the artist's critic, and that I was sort of, because I think, I could talk for hours about this, so I'll try and give you a condensed version. I think there's so many different purposes of a review, and the one that everyone jumps to first is to like let an audience know, right? If the show is good or not, if it's worth them spending money on. But there's also the idea of it being this permanent historical record. And also, and I was a teacher for 5 years, so I feel very strongly about this one, it's an appraisal for the artists as well. When you're reviewing something, it's not just for audiences, it's as much for the artists to talk about and to celebrate their work. And it can be a celebration. And that's my favorite thing to be able to do. It's always coming from a place for me of how to make this the best version of the thing that it's trying to be. And if I am getting frustrated, or if I'm getting particularly critical, it's because something feels within reach of being better, or the thing that I think that it ought to be, or a more successful version of itself. But it's lovely to have the opportunity, as I frequently do, to be able to uplift stuff and celebrate stuff, particularly if it's a show people might not know about, if it's something a little less buzzy, a little less talked about, regional theater, fringe theater, and to be able to give that a little bit more buoyancy in the social media sphere.
What draws you to a show in the first place? What leads you to choose one show over so many and say, this is what I want to go see today? Is it the actors, the story, any news you've heard about it?
That's a great question. I think so much of what I try and cover, because there's the stuff that I want to see, and then there's the stuff that I know people want me to talk about. So the boring answer is that I will just try and cover as much of the high profile stuff as I can. So like as many new Broadway openings as possible and the exciting West End stuff. When I get to use my discretion a little bit more and seek out the stuff that I'm interested in. For years, it used to just be a predominantly musical theater, the shows and the material and stuff that I hadn't seen or stuff that I'd always wanted to see. And there's still a bunch on that list. And then as time passes, it now gets to be about the writers and new writing and exciting directors and producers that I trust and theater companies that I trust. When you see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things, I think the really promising stuff gets to be a little clearer and it gets easier to spot. And also the red flags do at the same time. And occasionally I'll get a press release come through to my inbox and I'll think, well, there's just like three, too, like I really want to have faith that this is going to be exciting, but there's three simultaneous sentences here that make me nervous about whatever this is going to be. But that's why I like going somewhere like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, because you see like 5 to 10 shows a day. And so it's like moving on from one to the next, but also it's hard to say what is going to be the next exciting thing. And so that's just a really rewarding thing to be able to bounce between shows and have discoveries that might surprise you.
You said something that makes me think a little bit of what there's a relation to what we do, that idea of being the artist critic. Do you think of your audience as specifically an audience that's going to look to your video to understand the show they're thinking about going to see? Or are you looking at your audience also as the actor? And if part of your audience is the actor, do you think about how your words will be received? Because I think of in what we do, I always teach our students, it's not the responsibility of the patient to understand the information the way you want to deliver it. It's your responsibility to deliver the information in a way that it can be understood by your patient. So do you think about how you convey your message to your audience so that it's received in the way you intend it to be?
I definitely do. And I think, again, coming from teaching, I used to teach math to teenagers. And specifically, initially, my career was teaching math to teenagers who were doing arts-based courses. So they were doing performing arts or music or art and design or media. And this was a math qualification they all needed to get legally, and they had struggled to the first time around. So it was kind of adapting the usual way of teaching that for a more creative mindset. And so in that capacity, I had to be very purposeful about the way that I was structuring this. And it's like, I'm not going to tell you how I understand it. I'm going to try and figure out a way for your young minds, your young creative minds to understand it. And I think I bring that idea to theater criticism as well. In terms of how I actually talk about stuff, when I sit down and I'm staring at a camera and I'm in a room alone by myself, A, I try not to think about it that much. And B, the way that I have the conversation and the way that I word things is as if I was talking to a handful of people who had all seen the play before or seen the piece of theater before, as if we were discussing it. And I'd say every single time, share all of your thoughts in the comments as well, because I want it to be a discussion and sort of a response to it as much as anything else. But I do try and be cognizant of the fact, and I didn't think about this early on. In the earliest years of doing this, I didn't dare to dream that anyone I ever spoke about in these videos would ever find it. And then people started to. And now I gather that it is a very possible reality. And so I think it's important to be mindful about the way that you speak about people. I think that's still a lesson that could be learned by a lot of major critics in a lot of written publications. I think it's always the smart and decent thing to do, to try and find a way that doesn't individualize negative criticism either. Something I always say is that even if you're talking about a performance that you didn't enjoy, a performance is not an actor. A performance is a product of actor and director, as well as maybe half a dozen other people. It's scene partner, it's dialect coach, it's acting coach, it's stage manager. A performance, like every other element of theater, is a collaboration. And so you're talking about the product and not the people. And I think that separates it from being personal just that little bit more.
You've actually been one to not shy away from covering more controversial topics. Most recently, Kristen Chenoweth and her comments following Charlie Kirk, or Andrew Barth Feldman taking over in Maybe Happy Ending as a non-Asian actor. And I've admired you for that, for diving in and somehow conveying the facts, but managing to stay neutral towards it or giving your opinion, but not causing anything that would make anybody react angrily towards you. What makes you choose not to shy away, to dive in and cover those topics? Because it can cause risks, certainly amongst your fans or anybody who comes across your videos. And how do you maintain that neutrality?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. I think it's important to talk about. There are often videos that do very well as well. It would be very disingenuous of me not to say that, like, I know that having those conversations and addressing those topics, it's kind of a very buzzy thing to do on social media. But it takes us to places and conversations that I think are really important about like shared humanity and empathy and understanding and greater human connectivity, which in these times of global political challenge are really important conversations to be having. Again, I think it's the teacher in me wanting to kind of like be like, okay, well, there's an argument happening on two different sides of the room here. Let's try and find some sort of common understanding. And again, when I was in my earliest days of doing this, I'd have come onto the internet with a hot take and been like, I fall on this side and I'm going to really condemn this thing. And now, as you get a little bit more embedded in the industry, you come into conversation with different people and something happens and makes news headlines, and then you get emails and you get WhatsApps of people involved and people on either side saying, well, there's also this element of it as well. And so I like to try and find the middle ground of all of these controversial situations, but I'm always going to have an opinion on it as well. I think I've learned that about myself. I have an opinion about everything. I like to try and find a sense of peace and understanding in all of those situations.
In having an opinion and potentially having a really strong opinion about something, whether it's political, whether it's performance related, can you talk about the idea of separating the performer or the performer's perspective from the art? Because I can, speaking for myself, that's something I struggle with. I have a very hard time separating the performer from the perspective.
Yeah. And it's really difficult right now. And I'm not going to pretend that it isn't. And all of the feeling that this stirs up and all of the pain and this sense of betrayal is all particularly prominent because of this current political moment. So everything is felt, I think, much more acutely. And it's difficult because actors become the most public face of all of these productions, particularly leading actors, particularly famous, like celebrity adjacent performers. And I think I said when talking about the Kristen Chenoweth one that it's not that I disrespect the idea of not going because of the perception of her personal affiliations, political, whatever it is that she kind of said that we're still figuring out. But also, if the notion is that you want to boycott any production that has someone involved on that side of the political spectrum, you're going to find it among the producers. You're going to find it among the investors, and you're going to find it among the individuals who are benefiting the most financially from these shows. And so it's a difficult stone to overturn and consider what is inevitably going to be there underneath. In some facet, in the hundreds, thousands of people that make these productions work, there are going to be individuals who, if you were to meet them personally, you would wildly disagree with. Chances are that they're going to exist, but we only find out about the most prominent because they're celebrities. And it's not even something that was said publicly. This is something that was said in a comment. I don't want it to sound like I'm launching an enormous defense here, but it's because their movements are more scrutinized. I agree with the notion of separating the performer and their perspectives, but it's hard. It's really hard when you know about it. And if I think I'm only able to say that in this instance because of the ambiguity, it's the same thing that happened with Nicole Scherzinger in the earlier days of Sunset Boulevard on Broadway. And there was still something of ambiguity there. I think the current political moment being what it is, if things were said, if statements were made more explicitly, that would be really hard to put aside. And I think, yeah, it's a nice idea for calmer times, perhaps.
On the line of Eric's question, you've had the opportunity to interview a lot of these Broadway performers like Jordan Fisher and Andrew Barth Feldman. How do you separate, when interviewing them as the individual and the artist versus all the characters that you watch them play?
Good. That's a good question. I tend to only try and pursue interviews with people that I am a big fan of in any case. And my approach is always to try and, I leave myself very much out of it. I think the more It's really bad. But the more starstruck I get, the more I shut down and become unemotional. So I've approached people that I'm a lifelong fan of since childhood before, and I have seemed just thoroughly disinterested in them as human beings because I've gone so neutral and gone like, it's very nice to meet you. You're a very celebrated. And I've just completely shut down because the last thing I want to do is come across as a fan to somebody. And so when I'm talking to a Jordan Fisher, especially someone who I know is so popular, and all of my friends were so excited that I was going to get to chat to Jordan, I always think about, what does everyone want me to ask? What is the burden of, like, if all of the people who are going to see this, everyone who follows me, who subscribes, if they all got to ask Jordan one question, what is the question that they want to ask? So I have that going through my mind. And at the same time, I just like hearing them talk and giving them space to talk about the things they want to talk about. I always get very nervous about, I'm still newer to interviews, so I'm still overthinking them all the time. But I get very concerned about, what is the question that they get asked all the time, and how do I ask them something more interesting, and how do I give them a platform to go in the direction that they want to and say something more meaningful, or just have the conversations that they want to have. And also, occasionally, I've very rarely had an interview where we've had to cover anything resembling difficult ground. If I was to sit down with Andrew now and talk about maybe Happy Ending, it would be a slightly different conversation, one that I think, knowing him, that he would be, and he's not doing a lot of press about it right now, but I dare say, I don't think it's one that he would shy away from necessarily. But yeah, I've moved myself away from the question you initially asked, but those are various thoughts.
I appreciate that.
I was thinking I would get starstruck if I was interviewing. I'm starstruck interviewing you.
Oh, bless you.
So actually, the way that I found your videos was that I went to see The Last 5 Years a couple months ago. I went to see Nick Jonas because I'm a big Nick Jonas fan. So that's why I went to see it. I went in blindly and I walked out. I had no idea what happened. I did not understand the show. So I had to look it up. I Wikipedia'd it on my way home. And then I said, I need to hear somebody else explain this show to me. And I enjoyed it. I just didn't understand the plot. So that's how I found you. And you talked about stunt casting. Can you share some of your thoughts on stunt casting, when it goes right and when it goes wrong?
Yeah, I mean, and when it goes right, it can go so right. And I think we're seeing, it's getting harder and harder to know what we call stunt casting. And I'm seeing it used in a bunch of contexts that I don't think are applicable now, like with celebrated Broadway stars returning to the stage and people saying, oh, well, this is stunt casting. And I'm like, it's high profile and it's star casting. But if they won a Tony before they were ever on TV, that's not stunt casting. That's just a theater actor returning to what it is that they do. But it's becoming a necessity of the industry, particularly in New York, because of the way that ticket prices are being driven, because of how much more expensive everything is getting to produce, how much longer everything is taking to recoup. Star casting is becoming a reality because the only shows that are doing really well financially are George Clooney and Kieran Culkin and Sarah Snook and Jake Gyllenhaal and Denzel Washington. And so that's becoming the name of the game, is stars and celebrities. I feel like it's been a while, excluding like everything that's going on at Chicago, and you got to love them for it. I feel like it's been a while since we've seen particularly egregious star casting. And there are some from memory that would make Nick Jonas's performance in The Last 5 Years look fantastic. Like, there's various from the past that I think are considerably worse and had no business happening in the first place. And like, the keys had to be modified and the whole details had to be changed. And there's situations that have gone really awry in the past, but there's also been fantastic things. I mean, you could say that of Nicole Scherzinger coming back to the stage in Sunset Boulevard, because predominantly known for her pop career, despite having like stage capable talent. And those are the situations in which it goes right. And Jamie Lloyd, as a director and a producer, is great at picking out those stars and sort of subverting their celebrity just enough in ways that really work.
We've spoken to a lot of sound designers who do both Broadway and West End. Can you speak a little bit about the cultural differences from one side of the Atlantic to the other around theater, or where they seem to be very, very similar?
I think increasingly there is more and more overlap and more similarity. And I think social media is achieving that as well, because I think more so now than in previous years, it's easier to have an insight into what's going on the other side of the Atlantic. I think more American theatre fans knew about the Evita revival happening in the West End. And I think more West End fans are finding out about shows like Death Becomes Her and Beetlejuice, etc., before they ever make their way over here because of social media. I think it was harder to know about that in years or decades past. There are still differences. There's a whole bunch of things from a theatre-going perspective, but then also New York has a sense of theatre culture. It's really a neighbourhood for it. And the West End is not only geographically spread out, but it's also in London, which is the city that sleeps. So there is nowhere to go really after a show. It finishes at 10 p.m. and people are running to train stations to get home. Actors are running to train stations because the trains are going to stop running. The restaurants are closed. The bars are closed. So you don't have that thing of people going and talking about it afterwards and seeing everyone's playbills and saying, oh, we just saw that. What did you think about that? And so word of mouth is sort of harder to establish, I think, in the UK. I also think inherently we have a slightly different relationship to plays and musicals because the Golden Age musical comes from like vaudeville and Broadway is truly the home of that. And I think musicals and artistic new musicals, I'm thinking maybe Happy Ending, I'm thinking Dead Outlaw, stuff that isn't commercial, stuff that isn't based on a film, stuff that isn't based on any kind of existing IP. I think that is more respected on Broadway than it is in the West End, because what we value more than anything over here is the great play, because we're the home of Shakespeare and that kind of traditional theater. So a lot of times you see, and this is sort of critical differences, you see musicals reviewed over here with a little bit more cynicism because they're thought of as sort of inherently a little less than, but plays taken a little bit more seriously. And I think we just produce way more plays over here as well. But America is much better at supporting the writing and creation of new musicals. So that's like a developmental difference.
Is it harder for you to go into a musical or play? I don't know if any plays are duplicated in West End and on Broadway, but I'm thinking of like Great Gatsby offhand. Is it harder for you to go in if you see it in one theater, go to the other side of the Atlantic, see it there? Do you go unbiased or are you able to judge them separately, individually?
I mean, I love doing that. And I love having, I think, and it's not financially or logistically feasible, like the producers don't have the money for this and I don't have the time for this, nor do the other critics. But I think the best way to review anything is to see it at least twice. And on the occasions when I get to have seen something a second time before I speak about it, I always have more to say. And I always feel like I have a better grasp on it because the first time you are experiencing it and you're discovering it and it's all new and you want to let it surprise you and you want to have those discoveries and you want to be like, oh, it has the capacity to shock, and you get to find out what that genuine, authentic audience member experience is. The second time, you get to look for the foreshadowing, you get to see in the structure, you understand, oh, that first line is actually indicative of something that's going to happen by the end. It's sort of giving you its secrets at the very beginning, but it doesn't know that yet. And you can then see the structure and see the shape of the thing. So I love a repeat visit to anything. And I love to see it with a different cast. I love to see it in a different place. I saw The Great Gatsby in both. And I think I hadn't really reviewed the show until I had seen it in New Jersey, in New York, and then in London. And so it felt really thorough to be able to speak about not only a production I'd seen multiple times, but also this is what happens when you have slightly different performances in each role and see how that affects the whole thing as well. Because you do see differences with an original cast to a replacement cast, and also subtle things in like the Broadway reception and the West End reception. It's really minor, and a great show is a great show anywhere, but you can see little differences. Stereophonic is another one that I loved on Broadway and I loved again in London, but there's something special about the fact that some American performers came over to the West End and it has some British performers joining them. And so it's the story of this British American fusion rock band in the 70s, now played by a British American fusion cast. And there's something great about that as well. It's always exciting to revisit something. And yeah, I enjoy seeing things all around the world in different places.
I love getting the New Jersey shout out because we are based in New Jersey and the Paper Mill Playhouse never gets a shout out. So I appreciate it.
I mean, yeah, I have a dream to see theater in more parts of the US because for a long time, the goal was just Broadway. And then you start to go to other places and you're like, oh, this is amazing. I went to Chicago for the first time this year and was blown away by the theater scene there and the creativity and the artistry. And I just went to San Diego last weekend. I saw the Softs National Tour. That was a great example of seeing a show in a different environment. And I think that whole tour, as that heads around the country, especially again because of the timing politically, it's going to be so interesting to see how that's received and to see how audiences engage with that in different places as well. And so, yeah, it's often less about what's happening on stage and more about the context of how it's being produced and where it's being produced and what that means to the audience.
Something that's come of other conversations we've had on the podcast, specifically with sound designers, because a lot of the designers we've spoken with not only work Broadway and West End, but will also design for touring productions. And an idea that surprised me that came up was how different cultures, different regions will have different sonic expectations and how the designers then have to think about the sound. That one of the examples given was that a British audience might want more high-end, more higher frequency component to the singing that an American audience may not. Do you think about when you're seeing productions in different regions, how that sound may be different to your ears and what your preferences are sonically when it comes to performances?
I mean, now I will. Now I'm going to be thinking about it all of the time. I don't know that it's something that had occurred to me, but it makes an awful lot of sense because of the difference in sort of the natural timbre of the vocal types. That's really interesting. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'm thinking about The Great Gatsby in my head because we mentioned it. And that's an interesting one because the theatres it's playing in, or the theatre it was playing in London versus the Broadway in New York, are very different types. And so often what I'm encountering most is the balance between actors and orchestra. And it was playing at the London Coliseum, huge space, often used for opera here in London, which is sort of notorious for struggling to get that sound balance right. And especially depending on where you are in this enormous space as well. And I think I never go to a Broadway production and want everything to feel more impactful and feel louder. But I have that experience sometimes in London where I just want it to hit me in the face a little bit more. And I wonder if that's in keeping with a London sensibility. I don't know.
Could be. And I wonder also if there are, we've heard this also from engineers of, for example, stadium shows, that there can be regional guidelines for how loud the average sound can be over a period of time. That I wonder, we'd have to look into that if that's a factor in West End that may not exist on Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, both have theaters that are so proximal to each other. But I mean, I do remember we have, I think Broadway has more that share walls, but we have a couple on Shaftesbury Avenue, and old buildings, ours, because everything is that little bit more historic. And so I've seen plays before in the Apollo Theater, and I would hear Michael Jackson beats coming through from the wall next door in the Lyric Theater, which, and that show is no longer there, but that's definitely. And also I never hear train noise in New York, but there are a bunch of theaters where you can hear it in London. If you see anything at the Garrick Theatre, you will hear and feel the underground going beneath you. Yeah, there's a couple of places where that becomes a thing.
Interesting.
Wow, that really can affect it. This should have been the absolute first thing that I asked you, but we get off track. When you're walking into a performance, can you walk us through how you analyze a performance? What priorities you have as to what makes a good production and how you ensure a fair critique?
That's a great and really big question. So I think I still go in with the mindset of an audience member, but I'm looking at it differently. I think it took a long time to be able to do this, but there's a way of just being able to sort of switch that part of my brain off or look at it explicitly through a critical lens. But my mindset is always going to be, how, to what extent is this working for the audience here? Like, I hate reading a comment that's like, this was terrible and it wasn't funny. Everyone around me seemed to be enjoying it and laughing hysterically, but I know better. I think that's the most obnoxious thing. And it's so out of set. That's the day that you have sort of disconnected from the audience that you are in many ways meant to be representing and meant to be sort of seeing this thing on behalf of. And so I like to try and see it that way. And I do pay attention to audiences around me. There's different schools of thought about this, because some people say, especially if you're there at a press night audience, that it's going to be a more positive one and it's not reflective. But I like to pay attention to the extent to which people feel engaged and where the laughs are happening and where the reactions are happening. But It's my own response to it intellectually, emotionally, that I'm thinking about the most. And those are the frontiers on which I kind of judge anything. There's technical stuff that you can see more easily, like how slick does this look and that sort of thing, and like the rhythm of comedy and whether that's working. But then at the end of something, I will ask myself, to what extent was I emotionally engaged with this? Was I moved by this? Was I empowered to feel anything? Did I feel as though it was saying anything with the material? Did that come across? Was that communicated effectively? And you're holding all of that against your perception of what it is that the show is trying to do, that that piece of theater is trying to do. To what extent are they achieving their own outcomes? Because the way that you judge a Titanic versus an Angels in America are two very different shows. And so to what, how like a five-star version of that thing is going to be very different to a five-star version of that thing. How well are they doing what it is that they want to do, or what it is that I think that they ought to be trying to do, which is a bit of a sticky question, but that's where nothing can ever be completely objective and where it becomes my own opinion and my own interpretation of it.
You just talked about feeling moved at the theater. And that got me thinking back. It was probably about a year ago, we did our first Broadway-related podcast, and it was with Meg Daugherty, who is a cast member of Wicked on Broadway. She was talking during that discussion about the first show back after being closed for COVID and how moving that was for her. And I think she said the performance itself was 17 minutes longer than usual because of all the ovations within the performance. Can you recall a time being at a show where you felt particularly moved by the moment or the performance?
I mean, I was lucky enough to go to a bunch of those because I started really leaning into creating content on YouTube in the early months of 2020, like January 2020, with no foresight about the fact that the world was about to end. And everyone else sort of stopped at the same time. I owe a lot of my rise to prominence on YouTube by the fact that I was the only person doing it for a few minutes there. And then things started to reopen. And so I'd been talking about every stage of reopening. So I was like, I want to go to the reopening show. And in New York, a lot of stuff opened simultaneously. I think Kristen Chenoweth famously made the reopening speech at Wicked and then went to go see The Lion King, which is still hilarious. But we had them on very spread out different nights. So I got to be at the reopening night of Come From Away, which was so emotional, and a show where people can't applaud for, I think there's only like two applause breaks in Come From Away in over 90 minutes. So it was this huge pent up emotion by the end, but also reopening night of Wicked. And before each of them, I was trying to think through, like, what's the line that's going to suddenly strike us in a different way? And it's still happening now. We're still seeing shows, I think, in a different light, because globally, I think we've sort of been forever changed by that experience. I think it had a really big impact. And I think it changed people and it changed society an awful lot. We saw that in the shows that struggled or thrived in the immediate years following the reopening. I remember Wicked, everyone knew they were going to applaud it. It's good to see me, isn't it? Everyone was ready for that. And no one had thought about the end of the show when she gives the speech and says, friends, we have been through a frightening time. And everyone was like, oh no, didn't see that coming at all. Just suddenly emotionally devastated. But another one that I immediately thought of when you asked is, I was so lucky I got to be at the Broadway reunion concert in April 2023 of Ragtime at the Minskoff Theater in New York, reuniting many of the original Broadway cast. And I started crying at the beginning. I just kept crying the entire time. I was profoundly moved and wildly dehydrated. It was the most genuine, just like instinctive leap to your feet standing ovations I've ever experienced. And it was the sort of a rapturous response of a room full of people who knew they already knew and loved that material and those performances. So it was pre-met with this just extraordinary response. So yeah, that was incredible.
The complete opposite end of that spectrum. For a show that you walk out of not enjoying or not feeling moved by, how do you manage to pull out the slight and few positive elements of it so that you don't give a one-star? I don't think I've ever seen you give a one-star review, but how do you pull out those pros so that your review is not entirely negative?
Yeah, I think if I've given a one-star, it's only to like a major show other than something on the fringe. I think it's been maybe once. And for something to fall into that category, it has to also offend me in some capacity. I have to sort of resent something about it even happening in the first place. But it's exactly that. It's coming out. And I think the worst thing you can be is disappointed. And the advice that I give to audience members is setting your expectations is the best way, is the best means of enjoying a production. I've seen things before that I would describe as middling or like minimally engaging or minimally entertaining. But if you set your expectation level in the right place, then you needn't be disappointed. And the worst thing that I can be is disappointed. And it is, in those instances, a real searching for like, what part of this did I latch onto? And I think you do it instinctively when you're watching something that feels boring or that feels minimally emotionally involving. You are looking around the space to be like, someone grab me, something. And it's because I'm willing it to do well. I am willing to have a good time. And so I sort of in the moment, I'm searching for those things like, am I connecting more to that performance? Do I believe you? And then you start to zero in on what the real problem area is, which is a hard enough thing to do because often I think people see a bad show in quotation marks, whatever that means to different people, and just leave talking about the writing. But sometimes it's a direction thing and that's hard to see. And that's something it takes a long time to be able to pull out. What is the writing? What is the performance? What is the direction? Because you can't isolate the direction and you can't see it in the same way. So you're trying to grasp at like, is something about the connectivity of this? It's something about the overview. It's something about the way that it's not empowered to have a perspective on its own material. But yeah, just I try really hard to look for the positives and celebrate the stuff that deserves celebrating. And also, this is something I used to do, and I should probably do again, is I used to finish every single review by saying, here is somebody or a group of people who I think would like this anyway, and who should still go and see this. And my thing always used to be, go and see it for yourself, regardless of what I say, and then make up your mind for yourself.
What you just said stood out to me, this idea of maybe there's somebody for every show. Have you gotten feedback on reviews that you've left where it shifted your perspective of maybe, you know, when I sat there, I didn't consider that element or that didn't hit me or strike me in the moment, but then maybe you saw it again and that had more relevance or more effect on your perception of a show. Can you speak to a time where that maybe happened?
I think so. I'm trying to remember specifically. And there's a couple of occasions where people have sort of shared. It's often when people connect to things more personally. And I think Redwood was a show on Broadway that I thought was a little bizarre from a narrative perspective. And some people connected to that with extraordinary emotional specificity. And I think I said in my review, unless almost these exact circumstances have happened to you, I don't know that you would find it particularly moving or compelling. And some people evidently really resonated with that. And yeah, often the context of a lot of stuff is important. And one of our jobs as critics is to pick up on every little reference or salute to something that has come before. And I don't, because I'm 30 years old and I haven't seen all of the productions of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that were happening in the 80s and the 90s. So it's not something that I'm able to do. And occasionally someone will bring some brilliant illumination to my comments and say, this is sort of a nod to this that happened in the original production that I saw back in the 60s. I get some amazing insights, which is why I always welcome people sharing their own perspectives, because people bring some really interesting things. I don't need for people to agree with me every single time. Some people get very upset when they disagree with me for the first time. And it's like, we've broken a multi-year streak, but it's an impossible thing to try and aspire to. And I celebrate everyone being able to shape their own perspectives and their own opinions. And I'm very grateful for the occasions when people can share with me how and why something really spoke to them. I think that's fantastic. And I see pieces of theater that I know are speaking more specifically to me than they will do to a whole bunch of other people.
I want to piggyback on something that you had said about some of the complexities of certain things that can be done in other aspects of the production, whether it's sound or costume design. We were speaking with Cody Spencer, who's the sound design for Outsiders, and he was talking about the moment where they're dunking somebody's head underwater, and you hear the muffling within the theater. You hear the muffling of the sound, where I feel like that was an easy idea to overlook and not necessarily recognize the complexity of it because it just fit in the moment. Can you think of a show or a moment where there might have been some aspect of production that wasn't particularly the actor communicating to you, but something that stood out as a wow sort of moment?
I mean, I get really excited by sort of stunning feats of direction, which The Outsiders also had. And this was like this, and then actors are involved in this as well. But that second act sequence and the fight that happens in that show is really fantastic. What's interesting about the moment that you describe is it's something that is designed to sound so natural. The audiences aren't meant to notice it. But unless you sit there in the theater and think about, oh, I'm seeing this live on stage. This isn't a film. This is just that's something that you're so used to happening on screen inherently. And you're sort of immersed enough in the world, hopefully, that you're not able to really take the time to think about it because you're not processing everything. And that's sort of another difference in what I'm meant to be doing when I'm sitting there and sort of being a little bit more analytical about everything. Once spoiled I'm going to try and not spoil it here. It's a popular thriller play, and I spoiled it for myself because there was an automatic garden light, the kind that would turn on when you go outside of your back door on the set. And I remember thinking, did they just go out and buy one, or is that cued? Is that being cued by the lighting desk? And then there's a moment when it doesn't come on, and I was like, well, I guess it's cued. And then I was like, no one else around me is gasping at this, but the fact it hasn't come on is actually a huge indicator of the entire, that's the kind of a real secret to unlocking what was actually going on in this spooky play. And yeah, I think there's a lot of tragically unnoticed, because they're not meant to be noticed, technical moments that people have slaved over. And I think it must be simultaneously so rewarding and sort of soul crushing to have them just fly under the radar after weeks of trying to bring them together. I love a great like puppetry moment. I love a really satisfying illusion moment. I saw a production of Disney's Bedknobs and Broomsticks where somebody flew through a window, and I remember slapping the person who was with me very hard on the leg in just utter shock. There's so many. I get excited by, I think in that review of the last 5 years, I spoke a lot about lighting and moments there. And sometimes there's so much great stuff. There's so much.
Love asking people, mostly sound designers, about what happens when things go wrong. I love hearing about that.
No,
and what they,
not you.
I love asking people about what happens when things don't go as planned. How do they get around that? So you're not doing anything wrong, but you might be witnessing things that go wrong. Have you witnessed something on stage or behind the scenes where something clearly went wrong, and how they handled it, or how it was for you to watch something go wrong?
Oh, I mean, I've seen a couple of great show stops. There was a moment in a performance of Sister Act when they're performing at the very end of the show. They were so close to down home stretch, and the Pope crosses in a little Pope mobile, and the Pope mobile stops working middle of the stage. The Pope has to evacuate and run off, and because of the way it's staged, the front line of dancing nuns can't tell that everyone else has been evacuated. And so they continue, and the music is continuing as fewer and fewer people are on the stage, and someone has to come and rescue these nuns individually from the front of the stage. That was hilarious. But also, I mean, yeah, there's been technical hiccups and sound things. I've probably blanked it out, because you try and do right by that show by disregarding it. But yeah, I've definitely seen moments where things have crumbled entirely. I used to do a lot of amateur theater. I still do once a year a 24-hour musical. When you arrive on the Friday night, they say to you, guess what, we're doing Cats or whatever, and you spend literally 24 hours rehearsing to do it the next night. And also they build the set, and they figure out all the costumes, and they plot all the lights, and they do everything within that 24-hour period. And so that was rife with things going brilliantly and hysterically wrong, which is sort of what the audience is hoping for as well. Because if you're going to see a 24-hour musical and it's perfect, you'd be very impressed, but I think you'd be leaving a little bit disappointed. And so we had things like The Wizard of Oz, when the witch melts and then they're all celebrating, and then very loudly and very clearly, as though she's on stage, you hear the witch's microphone still live having a chat with someone in the stairwell. about the fact that she's got like 7 minutes now. She's going to go and chill in her dressing room, saying to someone like, no, I've melted now. I'm good. I'll be back down in a bit. And yeah, it's been so many great stories.
You had brought up Redwood, and this is going to be the weirdest thing I'll say to any guest on any podcast ever. When I need a good pick me up or I need a good smile, I will turn on your review of Redwood because I think it's I think it's hilarious. I think that's my all time favorite. Redwood was actually one of the only productions I've seen twice, because the first time Idina Menzel was out for the night, so they let us see it with the standby, and then see it a second time. And it was a show I didn't need to see twice, but I did. But one of the components in it was that there were so many LED screens, and the tree was not a real tree. How do you think that digitizing a lot of shows, incorporating so much more LED, is affecting the authenticity of shows?
Authenticity is, I think, the great word there and the thing to strive for, because it's what audiences respond to. I was just asked the other day questions about Gen Z as audiences in theater and what they prioritize. And I think one of the answers to that is authenticity. I think the future generation of theater goer really cares about authentic casting and authentic storytelling. And you make a really great point in that it was really visually impressive what they managed to achieve. And it was beautiful. And I've never seen the Redwoods in person, but I know people who have, who said, like, it can't aspire to creating that same sense of majesty. And I think the more you try and literally transport an audience with literal imagery and a giant tree on stage, whatever it might be, you're sort of doomed to fail if what you're trying to conjure is that same extraordinary natural thing that you just inherently can't bring on stage. And I think I will get always more inspired by the innovative and creative stuff that allows us to understand the emotional significance of that and what seeing that means to her, rather than we're all looking at a big tree together. And I think, yeah, authenticity, it's something we're kind of moving away from a little bit. I see more and more, I mean, we're seeing LED screens in more and more shows. I'm seeing AI-generated imagery on more and more of those LED screens. And it's dispiriting to sort of feel like there's less innovation, there's less creativity, but also it does feel inherently pretty inauthentic.
And that taps into my next question, which was, how do you see AI impacting theater?
Oh, God, I have such fears about it. But I think it's getting harder and harder to discern, especially in production artwork. In the earlier days of it, and I only mean by earlier days of it, I only mean like a year, 6 months ago, you could tell. And this year at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, looking through all of those different shows, there's a program with literally thousands of posters in it. And I was seeing more than ever before a lot of obviously AI-generated imagery. And this time next year, when I've looked through that program, I don't think there will be less, but I think it'll be harder to tell. And I think that's scary. And it's an interesting conversation because I know a lot of production artwork designers who use it as a tool. And so there's sort of a conversation about the inevitability of AI and the responsible use of AI. But I've also just recently seen shows that have AI-generated images on stage that are so clearly garbled and ridiculous and sort of distracting and uncomfortable at the same time. I think it's going to mean worse things for film than it is for theater. And hopefully that sort of reminds audiences of the importance of theater, that there's so much of it that just can't be faked. I mean, there's films where I think someone's accents were sort of enhanced or slightly constructed using AI, but there's an awful lot about theater that disqualifies it immediately from even being a possibility, which is a big part of why I love theater and why we all love it. And so hopefully it's the invasion of AI into the theatrical space is only so finite, but I think we're going to keep seeing it for sure.
So my last question for you is about the experience of taking in a show. I often walk out of the theater feeling like I need at least 24 hours just to process everything I've seen and organize my thoughts. So what advice would you give to theater goers on how to really absorb a performance so that they can leave with their reactions and their reflections a bit more grounded and clear?
Sure. I think I like to respond to stuff and know I like to be a blank enough page to the material that it still has the capacity to surprise me. But at the same time, I think it's good to familiarize yourself with it to a certain extent. And if it's a revival production, then I try and view it through that lens. And so I want to familiarize myself with the material and with the original version so I can speak to what changes, what choices did they make about this version of the show. And if you're a theatre goer, I think there's something to be said for just being really present during it, but also having some sense of expectation about what you are anticipating, because then you're just measuring it against that. And then you're just figuring out sort of, what was I expecting this to be? What actually happened? Was I more or less emotionally connected to this than I expected to be? Did that surprise me at all? And yeah, I think just sort of, if you can figure out, I always like to listen to what writers have to say about their work and what directors have to say about the work, which is also usually going to be some kind of a spoiler-free synopsis because they don't want to tell you what's going to happen. And then if the actor is particularly integral to it as well, also hearing about their perspective on it, I think that's great stuff to listen to and read up on beforehand. And then you can go in and just see how you feel about it.
I just get amazed at how articulate you are when you give these reviews. I'll listen to you and your reviews and hear you use these words I haven't thought of in 15 years that I'll just pocket away for later. You have such an ability to put your thoughts into words in a way that so many of us just put our words and it's gibberish.
That's very kind of you. There's plenty of gibberish that happens before I sit down and talk about it, and plenty of phrases that I think I favor too much. And I'll sit and I'm filming for twice as long as anything that you see as well. So there's sentences, I can't remember what word it was recently, but there's something like the word similarly, trying to hit the first L in similarly, that I said something like 15 times, and I can hear my partner laughing through the wall, and I'm like, leave me alone. I'm going to get there.
For my last question, if you're stuck on a desert island, what are the top songs on your playlist?
Oh my gosh. It's really hard. What are my desert island playlist songs? I think, and it's not necessarily indicative of the shows that I think are the greatest of all time, because those are like as a product. But I think you need something uplifting and you need something life-affirming. Let's say Being Alive from Company, and then I have some Sondheim on there. Let's say the opening from Ragtime, because I think it's one of the best book musicals ever written. And also it's really, really long. So that feels like cheating. And I need some contemporary musical theater in there as well. I'd say Helium by Jack Godfrey from the new musical, hopefully Broadway bound musical, 42 Balloons, but it's sort of soul crushing as well. So I feel like that's not a great thing for me to listen to on a desert island. We need some pep. We need some pep in there. And I'm going to say Up the Ladder to the Roof from Everyday Rapture, Cheri Renee Scott, Lindsay Mendez, Betsy Wolf. That will always, I could be marooned on a desert island and the high belting in harmony going into the last chorus is always going to put a smile on my face, even if I'm starving to death. Yeah.
Way to end the podcast. Well, Mickey Jo, it has been such a pleasure. I've been really excited for this one
It
did not disappoint one bit. So why don't you tell our listeners what's next for you? Where you'll be finding yourself across the globe because you're all over the place. So what's next for you and where they can find you, where they can find your reviews, where they can connect with you?
So over the next couple of weeks, I'll be seeing as much as I can in London before next month heading back to New York to see the first few openings of this new season. Very excited. Lots of Broadway stuff, lots of off-Broadway stuff. I am going to be in town for about 2 weeks, which it materializes might not even be enough time because there is so much that I want to see. And then next year, I haven't given much thought as to where exactly it's going to take me yet. There's a lot of places that I would like to go. The trouble with traveling is I now fall in love with all of those places. And I want to go back to San Diego already. I want to go back to Chicago. I want to go back to Germany and Paris and see all of the theater all around the world. And often it surprises me the places I get to go. So we can all be surprised together. But you can find everything that I have to say about theater, the reviews, the vlogs, the news breakdowns, on YouTube at Mickey Jo Theatre. I also share almost all of that content on all of your major podcast platforms and anywhere else that you can get social media. I say anywhere that there is theatre fans on social media where there is limited fascism, those are the places that I like to be. So that's Instagram and TikTok at the moment.
Awesome. So we'll link to all those in the episode description. And Mickey Jo, thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today.
Amazing. Thank you both so much.